Welcome to Self-Compassionate Professor, a career wellness podcast for mid-career and recovering academics who want more. More meaning, balance, rest, joy, and more clarity. Our motto here is no regrets. So glad you're here. Welcome, welcome. This is episode 84, and I'm Danielle Delamar. Thank you for joining us today. Y'all, I had the best conversation with Dr. Angela Gist Mackey, who is a tenured professor at the University of Kansas and who used to have an advertising career and who also is the co-founder of a consulting and coaching business. Angela thinks about her work in such fluid and flexible ways. And you're going to be able to hear that throughout this episode. She talks about, like, if you're not happy with academia, here's how you get out. Here are some of the things you need to be doing to write that next chapter. And she has this solid advice because she's been also career coaching for a long time. She also has advice for you if you just want to feel better in your academic career. Advice about, you know, choosing your commitments wisely and really taking care of yourself. I guess my favorite part of the interview is when she talks about sort of her family legacy and what that meant for her in terms of understanding her own purpose as, you know, social justice work, as, like she said, breaking as many glass ceilings as she could for Black women. She uses the term divine purpose, and I just love that because she links it to, like, her family legacy and history and the way that she is changing higher ed from sort of the inside by doing the work that she's doing, by doing the scholarship that she's doing. But then she also takes her expertise to communities outside of academia with that same sort of social justice purpose. It's such a good interview. There are so many thought-provoking ideas, as well as just the solid advice for my audience, for academics who aren't doing so great in their careers and they're trying to figure out what to do. Here's the interview now. Thank you for joining the conversation today. I'm talking to Dr. Angela Gist Mackey, Associate Professor of Organizational Communication at the University of Kansas and co-founder of Mackey Consulting, LLC. Angela, thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, so excited to be part of your podcast.
What I love about your being here is that you have still, you know, walked this self-compassionate path. That's the language I use. But this path that sort of works for you, and that path took you into academia from an advertising career.
Yes.
Which is a different path than many of my guests. It's sort of interesting that you went from advertising to academia, and that's really where you sort of found your footing. Tell me where I'm wrong.
No, you're totally right. So I did my bachelor's and master's back to back, and they were both they were in the journalism school with an emphasis on advertising, or some schools call it strategic communication. And then after I finished my master's, I wanted to make a little bit of money. So I really enjoyed the master's program. I can say that that was part of what sparked my interest in the PhD, was I really loved going to my seminars once a week, having these really in-depth discussion about the literature and scholarship that was happening in that area. And I looked at my professors at the time and thought, this is an easy gig. You can come to class and tell people what you think for 3 hours and get paid a salary. I might go back to school one day. And I mentioned that in passing to my mom, and she never let that idea go. But I, you know, was headed into this career of advertising agency life. And so I, you know, left my master's degree program. It took me about 5 or 6 months to find my first job. And then I started working at a mid-sized agency in the Atlanta, Georgia market area. And agency life was crazy. Agencies spend a lot of time crafting their organizational cultures, and I became fascinated with that. I had done an internship in college where I had like toured a bunch of agencies, and I could see from one workplace to the other just how drastically their cultures would shift and change. And that began to be sort of a side fascination while I was working on this advertising career. So I stayed in advertising for about 4.5 years. And then the recession hit. And there were a couple things that were happening in my advertising career that landed me into this path of org-com. So one was the org culture piece, which I already talked about. The second was I had two supervisors who were bullies when I worked in advertising. And I was fascinated with how my relationship with them totally affected my quality of life. So at the last agency I worked at, the supervisor was so harsh with me and totally abusing her power. I would literally cry on my way to work every day. And I was just like, what is happening to me? Like, I was a very competent and confident professional up until working for that supervisor. And I began to question myself, my competency. Like, maybe I'm not a competent employee. Maybe it's been a ruse up until now, and this boss is finally showing me what I'm made of. But that experience, like, really shook me. And then the other piece was I started working with student interns in the agencies, and I really enjoyed working with students. And so that was fun to be able to mentor them and teach them about the agency. And so that gave me sort of a hint of that education piece. And all the while, my mother's in my ear like, didn't you say you were going to go back to school to get that doctorate? And I was like, lay off, Mom. I'm doing fine. And I had been doing well. I had more than doubled my salary in 4 years of working in advertising. I had been promoted twice. I was working on global clients. Like, I was in a really good place professionally, except for the whole bullying piece. But then the recession hit. And my agency that I was working for at the time decided to do a round of layoffs, and they laid off everybody who had been at the company for a year or less. And I was on that list. So, you know, we were in the office getting our pink slips. Now, mind you, my boss is a bully, so I had never been more pleased to be laid off. Like, I was like, this is my out. Like, I was very excited. I was probably the only person in the room not crying, and I was gleefully going back to my desk to pack my things. And at that moment I thought, well, this is probably a good time to apply to grad school. And while I was packing up my things at my desk, the HR director came over and she said, I need to speak with you. And I'm looking at her like, what else do we have to talk about? Like, I've just been let go. I'm getting rid of this job. You know, I'm going to apply to school. And she told me that, while we were in our meeting, getting our pink slips, someone else had resigned and they would like to offer me her position. And I thought, well, it's probably better to stay employed while I apply for grad school. And so I took that job and stayed on, although that was a whole experience in and of itself, because IT thought I was delusional, because I was like, no, I'm really like hired again. And they're like, no, your name's on the list, honey. You can't stay. So I then applied to grad school. I only applied to one PhD program, and I didn't know what kind of program I was looking for. But I knew that I was fascinated with work and work life and all the things that had happened to me when I was working in advertising. So I just started looking at, communication, but I knew I didn't want to study media, which is what my previous two degrees are in. I was fascinated with communication between people, like between supervisors and their direct reports. I was fascinated with organizational culture. So finally, when I found the label organizational communication, I was like, that's it. That's what I want to study. I didn't want to go to business because I knew a lot of folks that had their MBA, and I was trying to find a degree that would differentiate me from that. And I thought communication was tied to the work that I had done previously in the journalism school, so that seemed comprehensive or coherent to me as an area of study, although I would now be studying people instead of media. So that's sort of how I entered into that, you know, sort of space, and I got accepted. I never actually thought I'd get accepted. I got accepted, and I remember flying up to talk to who ended up being my dissertation advisor. She was the director of grad studies at the time. And she said, do you want to study advertising or do you want to study people? And I said, I want to study people, like at work. And she was like, okay, this is a good program for you. Okay. And at the time, I was just rebuilding a relationship with my father. And my I grew up in a single parent home. My mom raised me. And I had little to no contact with my father and his side of the family. And after I like got accepted, you know, I had just been talking again to my dad and I started that relationship sort of in my mid to late 20s. And he and I were talking on the phone and I said, you know, I've been accepted to this PhD program. And he was like, that's awesome. He was like, you know, my sister's a PhD. She's works as a professor. And I was like, what? And I didn't know that. And he said, yeah, oddly enough, her expertise is in organizational behavior. And I was like, what? which was crazy to me. I just had no idea that there were other PhDs in my family. And then come to find out that his dad, my grandfather, was also a PhD. He had his PhD in chemistry.
Wow.
So this unpacked then a whole host of things for me to learn about my family history and lineage. And my mother did know that my grandfather was a professor. And I think she knew that my aunt was also a professor, but she never told me that. But then it made sense why she was kind of nagging me towards that path. Because she knew maybe that there was a, you know, a legacy there that I could carry on. But I think she also wanted me to make that choice for myself. So she never told me, you know, when I was applying that I would be a third generation PhD in a Black American family, which is pretty significant if you think about the timeline, because my grandfather earned his PhD in the 1940s.
Wow.
From Iowa. I think it was actually Iowa State in chemistry. And so for a Black man to do that in the United States right before civil rights really had hit its peak is just monumental. My aunt earned her PhD in the 1980s from University of Maryland, College Park. And, you know, she was one of the few Black women in business in the field at that time, earning their PhD. And so then the work began to mean something different for me, like earning this PhD, continuing that legacy. And so when my father told me, you know, my sister has a PhD, she works as a professor, then I thought, okay, so I should now really more intentionally broker a relationship with this side of the family. And so that very first year in my program, my father actually passed in August of 2009 was my first year. Mm-hmm. And so I had literally just brokered a relationship with this new aunt that I had no relationship with prior. And his passing brought us a lot closer. So she helped to mentor me through the PhD program. Hmm. She has helped to mentor me through the tenure track process. And she just retired a couple of years ago and just wrote a book, shameless plug, called Leader Humility, The Extraordinary Power of Leader Humility. So it's been amazing to watch her career and my career sort of start while hers was coming to a close. And now she's entering into a new phase of life in her retirement as a book author and speaker. So, you know, that's been a really sort of profound shift. But I would say that it's, for me, meant that this work is like a calling. You know, I feel a renewed sense of purpose around this work and on how to do it well, if that makes sense.
So I wonder if you'll talk about the calling and how, you know, finding this out about your dad's side of the family, what was it that made it mean, like, what was it about your PhD and returning to academia that meant something different now? Like, was there, what were you taking with you sort of on your journey that wasn't there before?
Yeah, I think part of it is this larger legacy of education and education in the Black community. So my grandmother, my father's mother, was also an educator. She was had her master's degree in education and was a teacher. Mm. And it made me feel a connection to a side of the family that I hadn't really felt a connection to before. I think it also feels like it's part of the work that I should be doing in a way. And so by should be doing, I mean like a divine purpose or a larger purpose of breaking through glass ceilings, you know, existing in spaces where Black women historically haven't been welcome. By that, I mean the academy. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I'm working in a very different time and place than my grandfather and my aunt did in the academy. But it feels like carrying the torch, if that makes mm-hmm. sense. And you know, it's interesting because to look back at like their work, my grandfather, I've held his dissertation. It was typed on a typewriter. If you can imagine typing a dissertation on a typewriter. Like the title is something I can't even pronounce because he was a chemistry PhD. So it's like, you know, looking at compounds and binding chemicals. My aunt, you know, coming up as a woman in the 80s, earning her PhD in a primarily white masculine field of business, I cannot even imagine mm-hmm. The types of things that she has been up with. And she shared a bit of that struggle with me. So I'm at a place in space where, you know, diversity is at the forefront of higher education. We're now, I think, having to reckon with some of the demons of higher education and lack of diversity in a way that wasn't happening when they were in the academy. And so it feels important to be able to carry that work forward. I also think about, you know, I'm a critical interpretive scholar, and so a lot of my work is around issues of inequity. And that feels very meaningful to me as a way to make a difference. I'm partnering with a lot of nonprofits. So it feels like I'm making a difference in my local community. And studying nonprofit organizations and partnering with them to make their human service programs and products better, you know? So that also adds a layer of meaning, I think.
And so is this part of what you're doing as a co-founder of Mackey Consulting LLC? What are you doing there?
Yeah, so my partner and husband, Dr. Charlie Mackey, finished his doctorate in he just graduated spring of 2021. Right. And, you know, we sort of thought we have like this intellectual space that we can own as, you know, highly educated Black family in the metro Kansas City area, which is where we are. And we thought we have a lot to offer, but also we're at a place where we need to put a value on that. And, you know, it's part of it is like, stop giving away your expertise for free. You know? And so we decided to just, you know, go out on a limb and start this consulting firm. So my husband's degree is in higher education and leadership, and he has a history in the sales industries, expertise in things like financial planning and insurance. And then my research has always looked at issues of like joblessness and unemployment and equity in the workforce, as well as in education. And I've done a lot of side sort of career coaching, if that makes sense. But I'm realizing that that has a lot of value to people, and that people will, you know, pay for that level of expertise. And so it felt like time for us to take ownership of that and to be able to share that more publicly. But also not to sort of overextend ourselves. And so we, you know, posted up this new consulting firm and we'll see what happens. So far I've gotten 2 gigs through it. So I'm going to be doing a keynote later next month, and that'll run through the LLC. And then I'm helping consult on some book chapters for textbooks, authors, and publishers, which is awesome. You know, it's a sort of a new space for us to be in, but since I recently earned tenure, it feels like I can now take on those sorts of projects, you know what I mean? And just sort of see where that consulting goes.
Okay. So before the recording, we had talked for a minute about how important it is to for you to be intentional about what you're going to do with your work. And you said you have had to do a lot of learning about how to say no in academia. And yeah. So I guess I'm curious about what the larger intention for your work is. And I think you probably talked about that quite a bit when it comes to sort of diversity, social justice and higher ed, that kind of thing. But how does Mackey Consulting weave into that sort of larger purpose?
Yeah, so, you know, ultimately our goal is just to help others and to help share the knowledge and expertise that we have. Mm-hmm. But to make sure that that isn't confined in the academy, that we're reaching out mm-hmm. to a broader public, and that we're reaching folks beyond, you know, the ivory tower, if you will. And so I think Mackey Consulting is one way for us to do that, one way for us to branch out, make a name for ourselves, but also sort of share this expertise and knowledge that we have with folks who are on the job market, folks who are trying to work toward financial stability. And, you know, part of that is really just like living out a dream that we have. My husband's ultimate dream is to work for himself, to work for our, you know, our business, and to not have to report, you know, to someone else. I enjoy the work that I do in the academy, but I also see how this work largely extends outside the academy. So throughout my years in higher education, I've also been hired to do like diversity, equity, and inclusion workshops, diversity, equity, and inclusion workshops. I've been hired to help coach people on virtual work. I've been hired to do, you know, keynotes about managing team conflict. And part of it made sense, like these are coming as just one-off requests here and there, but we thought, what if we could offer that as a more holistic package? Wouldn't it be more powerful to say, you know, we have this expertise that we harness, and how can we bring that into your organization, into your business, into your personal life through career coaching, through financial stability training? And so I think part of that mission is to get that expertise out of academia and into our communities, whether that be like in human social service organizations through me doing research with them, or whether that is just me doing one-on-one coaching with someone about what their next career chapter will look like. And so, you know, I think that's the dream, is really just to take that expertise and make sure that it has as far a reach as it can.
And what kind of people, in what sort of situations do you see yourself coaching, career coaching?
A lot of my research has looked at unemployment organizations and unemployment support groups. And many of the folks that I have talked with, you know, are wildly successful in their careers, but we hit some sort of economic recession or downturn like the pandemic has brought to us. And they're for the first time in 20 years finding themselves on a job market or realizing that this work is not as fulfilling as they thought it was, and are trying to reinvent their careers. So they're trying to make a hard pivot into a different career field entirely. So that's often a conversation I'm having. Another conversation, though, is about upward mobility. So working with folks who are coming from low-income backgrounds and are trying to, either through hard work or through education, trying to achieve a different status in their lives, and trying to help them figure out what resources are available to make that dream happen. You know, a lot of my research looks at social class inequity and poverty, and I've been working with a lot of nonprofits that are helping to break like generational poverty in families. And so again, that's the kind of expertise where I think a lot of people have a dream, but don't know how to make it happen and don't know what resources are out there to help them move toward those goals of upward mobility. And so I think that is part of the expertise that I can also offer, which I do on a pro bono basis with the nonprofits that I, you know, do research for. But it's about like bridging that gap between where you are now and where you want to be, and helping people maximize the resources available to them.
Okay. And so just because I feel like it is relevant to my audience, you talked about the first group and sort of the second group of people you're coaching. And the first group is like people who you said have been wildly successful. And then at some point, whether it's like external circumstances or internal, like they just don't want to do it anymore. They want to pivot out of the career they're in and move into something else. What sort of advice might you give to people who are in that space? My listeners who are academics who are really seriously considering leaving. Many of them are.
Here's what I would say is you have to do the translational work from your past experience to whatever future opportunities you want to obtain. And I think one of the hardest things about earning a PhD is that few people understand what the transferable skills are. We do, I think. So folks like me who've worked inside the academy and outside the academy can easily see the connection. But I think it's harder if you've only worked in the academy to understand how your skill set can be valuable to contemporary organizations or other potential clients out there. So part of it is understanding what their needs are and then seeing how that fits with your expertise. And so it's a part of it is a research problem, right? I mean, we're trained in how to do research, but you have to go out there and figure out like what are the organizational problems and issues that people are facing, and then how can the expertise that you have speak to that? But it's about making it accessible. So too often in the academy, we are, you know, esoteric in our language and speaking in abstract theoretical concepts that you need to speak to an applied purpose and a practical purpose. But what I've found is that a lot of what I do is very directly relevant to people in the contemporary workforce. It's just about me making that concept accessible, me making that research accessible. And that in and of itself is a service and a level of expertise. So don't sell yourself short. And I think the other piece is to not feel confined to prescribed boxes that people have for what are appropriate career paths, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So it's one of the things I love about the work that you're doing. You know, there have over the past, I would say 5 to 10 years, been this uptick in, I guess, entrepreneurships or organizations that are helping academics live better lives. And I see you very much as part of that. And it's something that we've needed for a very long time, but someone had to like broker into that space to show that it was needed and it was necessary. So, you know, to those folks who were imagining something different, like it just because you're the first one doesn't mean it won't be successful. And so it's okay to be, you know, in that space alone. It just means you're sort of a pioneer, even if you're a reluctant pioneer.
And speaking of imagining something different, I mean, this speaks to sort of your whole career journey. I find it so interesting that you went from advertising to academia, and now, you know, you have this consulting coaching business on the side, and you're willing to sort of, you know, work outside academia and inside academia.
Yeah.
And like you said, be intentional about what you say no to in academia so you can make sure you sort of keep your eye on the ball.
Yeah.
And so many of us don't do that. Imagining something different, could you speak to that a little bit? Like how people might be able to do it, how you've done it.
Yeah. I think so. Part of what was always a must have for me in this work was to be able to work in the community. And, you know, even my dissertation, I partnered with two nonprofits working those unemployment support organizations I was talking about. And, you know, there were naysayers. There were people like, you don't need to do that. That's too big of a project. You know, just do the dissertation and get it done. Do something quick. I had people tell me, don't be a qualitative scholar. Like that takes too much work and energy. You'll never finish. But I just resisted that. It's like, no, this is the kind of work I want to do. And in the midst of it, I was loving it and was like, yes, this is the kind of stuff I could see myself doing for a very long time. What I would say is I had to make sure that I found an institution that valued that kind of work and that was going to allow me to write my own story, if that makes sense. I remember when I was on the job market, I interviewed at another R1 institution who shall remain nameless. And in the interview, the chair of the department asked me, but you would be open to doing some quantitative work, wouldn't you? And that was like code for, nope, you're not going to be supportive. It was like, no, yes, but I want that to be my choice. So I am open to doing quantitative work, just for those of you who are out there. And I have published some quantitative studies since I've been here, but I should make that choice, right? And I didn't want an institution to dictate the type of scholarship that I wanted to do. And not every institution is supportive of a community engaged work. It takes a long time to do this kind of work. It complicates the research process because I'm negotiating access with different nonprofits, and I'm trying to also design research that helps them, not just serves my own purpose of promotion and tenure and publication. But I needed to find a place that was supportive. So, you know, KU gave me the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences just awarded me the Community Engaged Scholarship Award last year, which was awesome.
Yeah, congratulations.
yeah, it just is very meaningful to be in an institution that has an award like that, that is giving it out annually to different scholars across the different disciplines. And so that was part of it, was like choosing the right space, which is easier said than done. You don't even know sometimes if it's the right space until you're waist deep in it. Right. I think the other part is, you know, as an African-American woman in the academy, I'm often tapped to serve on a lot of committees. There's a lot of service opportunities. I get, you know, token labor, if you will, to participate in a variety of different things, some of which I would rather not. And I've gotten a lot better these last, I would say, 3 or 4 years about strategically saying no. I learned through the National Center for Faculty Development and Diversity, NCFDD. They were like, everything you say no to means that you can say yes to something else that you wanted to do. And so I've started holding myself to that. And through that boot camp, I learned that I need a no committee. So I have certain people that I trust that I take these service opportunities to say, is this something I should be doing or spending my time on? You know, and they help me vet the decision. I now never say yes to an opportunity the first time it's given to me, because I need to really think about, how does this align with my own career mission and vision for myself? And sometimes they don't, you know, sometimes it doesn't serve me well. And if it's not serving me well, I'm generally not going to do a great job at it. And so I can't help anybody if I'm overextended. So I get to choose the things that I sort of pour my energy into, and I can feel empowered to do that. So I've said no a lot more in the last several years. Last summer, when we had the Black Lives Matter protests, you know, and the murder of George Floyd, I was grieving, but that was also the time when I started getting tapped and asked to do all of these things. And I just said to myself, I can't. I'm not in a space where I would be good. I need to take care of myself. And so for about 6 months, I just said no to everything until I was in a better place to engage. And you know what? I thought people would, I don't know, ridicule me or criticize me for not stepping up to those very needed roles in diversity and inclusion. But honestly, people were much more compassionate. They were like, nope, totally get it. Absolutely. Thanks for considering. Mm-hmm. And so that was a surprise, right? That people were supportive and understanding that I needed to take some time for myself, and that I was not in a good place at that time, and that I needed to wait until I was at a better place where I could then begin accepting some of those invitations again.
So I guess right now, when I think about, you know, taking care of yourself, and I also think about some of the stuff you've talked about previously in terms of being bullied at your workplace. Mm-hmm. And I guess I kind of want to talk about sort of that intersection. Are you at a place where you are better able to take care of yourself in this sort of work environment as an academic than you were back in advertising, when, you know, terrible things were happening with two bullies in the office and trying to manage that? Is taking care of yourself different now? And I know the situations are different and all of that, but I don't know if you might be able to speak to that.
Yeah, I think I'm much more assertive about taking care of myself and being honest about what I can and can't do. But I also think that has come with age and wisdom. That makes sense. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, when I was in advertising, those was my first entree into a full-time career. And I was in my early to mid 20s. Mm-hmm. And I just was so unsure of myself about a lot of things. And so trying to soak up what professional life looks like and means. I was also underrepresented in those spaces. So even though I was working in Atlanta, Georgia, which has one of the highest Black populations in the country, the first agency I worked for only had 2 African-American employees, me and the receptionist. And so, you know, trying to always navigate being underrepresented was a task as well. I think that one of the ways in which this career helps me to better take care of myself is that I've now begun to write and publish around self-care. Mm-hmm. I've begun to write and publish around the things that have been traumatic in higher education. Mm-hmm. But those that writing and publishing, not only is it cathartic for me and helps me process all the emotions and experiences, but then it also becomes a form of production because I list it on the Vita. They are read, you know, they're shared. Those experiences go beyond the page, if that makes sense. And it's so fulfilling for me. I just got an email from a student at Wayne State last week who said, I really want to read your article, you know, looking at issues of social class and race. And so then she and I got to have an email dialogue around some experiences in the academy, and I sent her some other pieces that really critique the academy. So it feels good to be able to be part of something, but also to work to make that thing better. Mm-hmm. Whereas in advertising, I think I wasn't necessarily trying to make the industry better because I didn't know how, but I was just trying to survive it, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's the academy also, there are a lot of other things that I have to navigate. So I'm an avowed workaholic, I'll tell you that. And I was when I was in advertising. And the academy is a difficult place to navigate as a workaholic because I have to always kind of keep it in check. Mm-hmm. And I have to be mindful about, you know, how is that workaholism rearing its ugly head in particular times? The pandemic did not help, like being locked at home. I just said yes to a lot more things, and now I'm reaping the the consequences of that. But I think, you know, part of it is I do feel empowered to say no. I feel empowered to even back out of things and not, like, ruin my reputation, where when I was in advertising, I didn't feel like I had that because there was no sense of job security in that particular industry. And I don't know that I have a really strong sense of job security in higher ed because we're not doing well. My institution laid off faculty last year. But I do have a better sense in my ability to survive, if that makes sense. So even if higher ed doesn't work out in the long term, I know I have a really versatile skill set. You know, we've created this consulting LLC. I can do a lot, and I'm a very resilient person, and I think I have more trust in that, and that allows me to be more self-compassionate.
Is there something you would like to say in the end to help you to feel this conversation is complete? Is there anything sort of left out?
Here's what I think the message I'd like to send is that for all the folks who are in the academy that want out, don't feel afraid to explore that option. You know, I'm a person who strongly feels like the academy will be there for you if you ever want to come back to it. I think the other piece that I would say is for those of you who are in the academy who are really toiling with, you know, you want to be there, but you want to do it differently, then, you know, build a community of support to allow yourself to do it differently. So there are a lot of ways to do this work well. There are a lot of ways to do this work so that it runs you down and sucks the life out of you. There are a lot of ways to do this work so that it's actually fulfilling and, you know, filling your cup, not draining it. And so, you know, figure out what do you need to change in that career path to make this better serve you and your hopes and dreams and goals. One of the things that I, you know, love, so I absolutely am in love with teaching. I'm absolutely in love with my research. But I also know that this isn't the end all be all, you know, so I can take solace in the fact that this is just another chapter in my career path. But my hope is actually, you know, I'm going to retire early, and then my retirement dream is to own and run a coffee shop. So, you know, there's always something else you can be doing. And I think that don't be afraid to reimagine what the thing can look like, you know.
Great. Thank you. Thank you for that beautiful advice. And just so much of this work is about, you know, helping people to approach their careers with some psychological flexibility. And I think everything you've said is all about that sort of flexibility, you know, the versatile sort of skill set and the resilience. And, you know, this academic life is not the end all be all. It's all about just sort of looking for opportunities and being creative and figuring out what to say no to. Like, I don't know, I can feel sort of closure in this conversation. Like, it feels like we brought all the pieces together.
Yeah. Well, thanks for having me. One of the things I think that you're doing, which is great, is to get people to see that there are just other avenues. Too often in PhD programs, and I don't know if this was your experience, but we're taught that there's only one appropriate path, and that path is to get a tenure track job in an R1 institution. And that is so problematic in many ways.
Yes.
I had a
teaching class. It was a teaching communication class taught by Ann Darling at the University of Utah. And she was very good about, like, these are the different kinds of institutions you can work at. And she had a speaker from an R1, but then she had speakers from, like, you know, a liberal arts college. And like, it was really helpful, because that was like in my first year. It was really helpful for me in terms of knowing that I could go other places and I didn't have to just go to the R1. But
I have grad students, because many folks know that I worked outside of higher ed before, who will sort of come to me secretly and shut the door in my office and say, I don't think I want to go into the academy. Can you help me put together a resume? And it's like, this should not have to be a closed door conversation. This is your life. You can do whatever it is you want to do. And so we have to normalize that in the academy, I think, that it's okay. And in fact, wouldn't it be a great world if we had PhD expertise out in our businesses and organizations and nonprofits and government?
Mm-hmm.
That would be a powerful shift. And I think we need to be more open to that.
Absolutely. So if people are interested in your work, both your scholarship as well as the work you're doing at Mackey Consulting LLC, tell us about where we can reach you.
Yeah. So my website, angelajustmackey.weebly.com. I'm not sure how you pronounce it. It has a lot of information about my scholarship. There's a video of me doing a research talk up there. It talks about my service as well as my teaching. I would love for folks to come visit. You can find me on LinkedIn, Angela Just Mackey PhD. And then also MackeyConsultingLLC.com is up and running if you're interested in the services that we've got there. We just launched it this year. So I'm excited to connect. Thanks for listening for all those folks who tune in. You are definitely consulting a wonderful expert in Dr. Danielle. Is it Delamare? Delamar.
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 Thank
awesome.
You.
Your work is so great.
Oh my gosh. Thank you so much. Dr. Angela Just Mackey, thank you so much for being here. It was such a powerful conversation, and thank you for imparting your wisdom.
Absolutely. Take care.
Thanks for listening to Self-Compassionate Professor. Find me on LinkedIn at Danielle Delamar, on Twitter and Instagram at Danielle SC Prof, or schedule a free coaching consult at selfcompassionateprofessor.com. Be well.